Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and we're going to look at having bug bites. That's our segment where we talk about different and interesting things in the world of insects, and I hope that you'll join our conversation. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment there, or send us an email. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Diane, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's always fun, Brian. In these deep winter months, we can still talk about insects, can't we?
Yes. Well, there are just so many interesting things that come up, and I just, about once per day, maybe every other day, I get something from Entomology Today about an insect that I either didn't know about or just something about that insect that I didn't know about. And the last month has not been any different than all the months before.
I'm wondering if you aren't a closet entomologist, you should have gone into that field.
I wouldn't be surprised. I really wouldn't, because they never grossed me out when I was little. It was always like, wow, that's kind of fascinating. And I still remember, when I'm in the garden, half of my time I'm actually doing something like weeding or planting, but the other half I tend to be in observation.
Mm-hmm, that's great.
And so
you're a natural born scientist. You should have pursued that.
It was the math.
Okay. Well, I can relate to that.
Well, our first one that we're looking at has to deal with mosquitoes, and we're bringing this up because of the Zika virus.
Yes.
And this one. Is entitled "A Clip-On Repellent Device Offers Protection Against," how do you pronounce the name of that mosquito?
Aedes aegypti
mosquitoes, which is one of the carriers for Zika?
Currently, that is the main vector, okay. Mosquito vector. However, if you've been listening to recent news on NPR, you've probably heard that they have been exploring another species of mosquito that also lives in warm, humid places, which is where this Zika virus is embedded, is another one called the Asian tiger mosquito, which also occur. Both Aedes aegypti occurs in warm southern locations in the North America, and this Asian tiger mosquito is spreading its range in North America. So that is a concern that yet another species of mosquito may become a vector for the Zika virus.
Now, the Zika virus is not new. It's been around for a long time, decades.
Right.
But they're only now just discovering that it might harm infants in utero, that their brain development, physical development, and so that's why we're
right. Why the concern?
At this right now.
I've been following the news. I think probably similar to many people, and from what I've picked up, it's not yet conclusive.
Yes.
That the Zika virus does cause the microcephaly and other conditions. But certainly there is some strong suspicion. There seems to be a lot of coincidental infections and with the virus, and then having pregnant women experiencing some problems with children. So it may be, that there is a link. They're still exploring that. But certainly it does seem like the Zika virus is, I don't want to say it's more common than it used to be, but it certainly has been at some high levels in places in Central and South America in this past, which is their summer. Our winter has been their summer. Yeah.
So this particular repellent, it's not a spray, but...
Right. It's a very novel...
So why don't you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, and actually, if you read all the way through the article down to the end, the authors come around to saying that they don't even think repellent is probably the right term to describe this type of device. But it's a very innovative device, and that's why it is so intriguing. And it's called clip-on. And so what it is it has this little container that contains an actual pyrethroid insecticide. So the synthetic pyrethroid insecticides are known. They're very common in all like our pet treatment types of products. It's in our kinds of insecticides that are registered to spray on humans for like tick and flea repellents, things like that, or to kill them. And so that's what this particular device contains. But it also contains this little battery-operated fan that blows the insecticide and basically like a cloud around the person who's wearing this device. And so they said that they saw efficacy up to a foot away, which isn't a great distance, but if you're killing mosquitoes that are trying to come at you and attack you within that foot diameter around your body, if that's working, that's which it sounds like with their tests, they were very impressed how well it did work.
Now, I'm thinking when I'm out in the garden, that's tend to when I get bitten or hear mosquitoes mm-hmm. buzzing in my ear. And I'm assuming they're coming to my head because the carbon dioxide has been given off.
Right.
But I also get bitten on my ankles.
Sure.
Because they're kind of exposed.
They are.
So if this, do you wear this device on your belt and then it gets all of you up to down? I'm just thinking, wow, yeah. What if I'm kneeling in the garden and it sprays out front, but nothing's
right.
in the back?
So. They didn't really talk about this in this article. There was a companion, more in-depth article, and I didn't read the whole thing. And this was just a preliminary test yeah. of the product. They were mostly standing or walking at a, you know, a reasonable gait. They weren't like running or, yeah. you know, or speed walking. And so they, with those kinds of movements, they felt that's when they saw the protection. They didn't explore activities like gardening or other kinds of things. But with wearing it, I think it wasn't on the belt. I think it was more on the torso someplace. I can't remember exactly where it provided that level. And it's, again, not repelling. What they actually found was in doing their studies with where they had collected the mosquitoes that were within that different ranges of the person wearing the device, they saw that it actually killed the mosquitoes. And so the term that they used at the end of the article, let's see if remind myself what they called it, that repellent might not be a sufficient term to describe the device because the insecticide cloud didn't just repel mosquitoes, it actually knocked them down and or killed them. So maybe something like a vapor active insecticide would be a better term.
So can you address this metafluthrin, which is what it's spraying?
Right. So it's a type of synthetic pyrethroid. So it's one that's been used in products for animal, you know, for pets and other kinds of livestock to treat, kill and treat for insect infestations. And so this group of insecticides has a fairly low mammalian toxicity compared to many other insecticide groups. So that's why it's been popular for this kind of use. But, you know, the wearer or person who chooses to wear this device would have to, you know, be willing to have that cloud of metafluthrin around them for that period of time that they're wearing the device. However, if you feel the consequences, you know, I could be bitten by a mosquito and have this you know, pretty nasty virus vectored to me, then maybe this is a better alternative for people who live and need to be outdoors in times when the mosquitoes are active. And that's one thing about these Aedes aegypti and the Asian tiger is that they are both daytime active mosquitoes. So these aren't just here in Utah, we're fortunate in that our main mosquito problems come, you know, right around dusk. And mm-hmm. so we can, you know, protect or be more careful. So if you're going to sit out on the porch on a summer evening, just put on a light jacket, make sure you've got on long, you know, long pants, and you'll probably reduce most of your mosquito bites. Whereas if you live in a place where they're out all day long while you need to be outside doing your activities, that's a whole nother level of challenge that you need to protect yourself from.
I was just thinking PM 2.5 in the winter or mosquitoes and metafluthrin. I don't know. It's probably not nearly that yeah. bad, but because they wouldn't have approved it, I would imagine.
Right.
But
it is,
still, like
it
you
is
said,
approved
it would be
for
concerned.
Human. Yeah, for human use. But I just thought the whole idea of this clip-on device with a little fan that blows the vapors of the insecticide around in a cloud around you was kind of a novel idea.
It is very novel. It is very novel. Well, let's take a look at our next subject. Researchers find hundreds of arthropod species in U.S. homes. So just when you thought your house was really clean, guess what?
Did this gross you out when you read this article? Yes,
slightly.
<Brian? laughs> Although I kept reminding myself as I was reading it that the study was actually conducted in North Carolina by researchers at North Carolina State University. And the homes, the 50 homes that they sampled were all in Raleigh, North Carolina, which I lived there for 7 years while I was a graduate student. And I can personally attest to it's a humid, hot location. And so I don't know that this is representative of all homes in the U.S. and probably here in the West with our drier environment. I would say we don't have as many as they do back there.
But we do have some.
Oh, we have some,
yes.
Definitely.
So I know silverfish. I've seen those before, and yeah. and I would imagine the older your home is, the more likelihood yeah. that you probably have
sure.
some of these
cracks and crevices where yeah. they can get in, damp places. So typically bathrooms, kitchens, under the sinks. But before we jump into other specifics, I mean, I know you've already read the article, but what would you have guessed would have been the if someone said, "Oh, everybody has insects in their home," which ones would you have said are going to be in the top of the list?
Well, I would think the ones that you actually see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking of my own home. So I usually get in the fall, the strawberry root weevil. Mm-hmm. Those tend to come in. Earwigs, I'll see, will come in. So the larger
right.
the larger insects. Weevil.
Yeah. And flies. Most people, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. you get some flies in your home. So those would be the ones.
Occasional spiders.
People would think, yeah, I know I get those in my house. So on the top of the list for this research, again, they looked in 50 different homes around the Raleigh, North Carolina area. And they found on average, they found a total of 579 different kinds.
Different
kinds of arthropods. That's not just the number of them. There are many more of that, but that's different kinds. And so this was around 304 different insect families. So that's very diverse. So just inside our homes, we have these very, very diverse insect and arthropod communities. And individual homes had an average about 100 different types of insects. And that ranged from 32 to 211. It was around 100 on average. So
32 was the low number.
32 was a low number. Somebody had a cleaner house than another. But so the types of insects were flies, spiders, beetles, which are like weevils are a kind of beetle that you mentioned, ants. So yes. not surprising. Mm. But then another one that was very common that most is very small and most people don't realize how common they are is an insect called book lice, which is actually the insect that's on the front of the article.
In Utah?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, if you want to, any books, I'm sure in my office over in the BNR building, but certainly going to a library where, you know, a concentration of books are kept, you can easily find book lice. And they feed on the glue and the other kinds of things that are on the paper. I don't know if they're not cellulose digesters, so they can't really consume the paper, but they eat debris and things that it's associated with books. But they're so small, and unless you have a very severe infestation, they're really not going to like your library books. The bindings aren't going to fall off or anything. So they're very, very common in places with books. Yeah.
And how large are these?
You can see them with your eye, but it would just be like a little speck.
You'd have to really be looking.
You'd really need a hand lens or a microscope to magnify them.
So what else? So we talked about silverfish. I know those are around. And it's interesting. Some of these insects have been around for a very, very mm-hmm. long time.
Yes. Yeah. And they mentioned that, you know, all homes had spiders. One of the more common types are the cellar spiders, which tend to be ones that are in dark corners, and so probably in your basement or your attic or a storage space. And these are actually in the same family as black widows, but they have no, you know, venom. All spiders have venom that they use for their prey, but I mean, they're not going to bite people, so they're not a mm-hmm. dangerous mm-hmm. spider. But they're very common around any kind of dark place that doesn't get disturbed very often. In the storage area, they'll build their very kind of those cobwebby kinds of nests. They're kind of messy nests, and that's what they catch their prey in. So those were also a very common arthropod that was found.
I noticed they also found insects that don't survive in the home. So I'm guessing somebody opened a door and it just
right.
happened to fly in or something.
So they mentioned that, you know, before we freak out that we think that all these insects are living with us all the time, most of the arthropods had clearly, you know, wandered in from the outdoors or been brought in on items that people bring in. Your plants, you know, wood to burn in your fireplace, you know, your shoes, you walked across the grass or something and they come in. So most of them were just accidental invaders, so to speak. They weren't coming into your home to find something in particular. Some of them do, like the spiders that are using your home as a habitat for them to live in. But most die pretty quickly. So despite those large numbers, around 100 per home on average, they're not living there for extended periods of time.
I thought this was interesting, too. It says what surprised the researchers was that only five of the 554 rooms did not contain any arthropod specimens
at all. So that just tells you that even though no matter how clean we think we might be with our regular vacuuming and dusting, we all have arthropods in our house.
Does this include the, what were we talking about when you were here before, on the eyelashes, the mites that are on the eyelashes.
Oh yes, and the face mites. Yes. Yeah. So they didn't know this was only looking in the home or collecting.
So we actually have more.
This was not counting what was on our body. So yeah, I figured this is my second time in a row I've been on where we're grossing people out. They might request that you not have me back on again.
Well, and some of these have also evolved and developed with humans. I mean, they've found an advantage of being indoors,
right.
And so that's where they come.
Exactly. And so I think that, again, despite our little squeamishness about thinking about all these arthropods in our home, we shouldn't, you think about human evolution and the kinds of homes we've moved through, back in time, we had dirt floors and, we were nomads and moved around. We might have used a lot of animal skins. Obviously there were a lot of arthropods associated with those kinds of environments. And in today's time, our much more sterile home environments really, I'm sure, have much fewer arthropods than they used to. But there was one other interesting thing at the end that they mentioned that based on this nobody had ever really done this before, looked in people's homes. We know we have insects, but nobody had really tried to quantify and classify the types that we have. And so now that they have, they mentioned that there's a lot of new research lines that can open up in terms of are these arthropods providing some services to us, either good or bad? I mean, we tend to think of things like cockroaches might be, bringing in a disease with them, but some of these might be bringing in beneficial microbes that we actually do need to have a healthy type of lifestyle. And so I think that's going to be a new avenue of research that certainly people are going to pursue.
Chocolate-covered cockroaches. I'm not sure about that.
And then just like you said, getting to understand the evolutionary characteristics that have made them better suited to live with humans. Why do some of these live so well with humans and others don't? We think about larger animals like coyotes or opossums in places that have those, or raccoons that tend to do very well in areas that have become more urbanized. And so those are larger animals, obviously. But obviously there's arthropods that have follow a same kind of track that as more and more land gets converted into homes and where people inhabit, that certain kinds of arthropods do very well there.
Now, I haven't really gardened and lived in a humid and warm environment since I was an adult, so I'm colored somewhat as far as my idea about what I love about Utah, but one of them is the drier climate.
I tried
and you have
to
lived
garden.
In both,
I
so.
Tried to garden in Raleigh when I lived there, and I have to say there were a lot of things that were not very successful. And people, we curse squash bugs here, and they are a tenacious pest, no doubt. But every attempt I tried at growing squash in North Carolina was stopped by the squash vine borer, which is a clear-winged moth that the caterpillar bores in the vine of the squash and kills it just so quickly. As soon as your little squash plant's looking good one day and the next day it's dead. So we actually have nothing to complain about here. I never could grow a healthy squash the whole time I lived there.
You probably missed it very much then.
I did. I mean, you could go to the gardener's market or grocery store and buy them, but just it was very frustrating. And all the potato beetles on the potatoes were just... I mean, you could literally vacuum them off with the vacuum. They
would
were so
abundant.
Would you have
to put on a floating row cover in order to keep them off?
Yeah. And, those kinds of... Now, it's been a while since I've been in graduate school. So those aren't new things, but they really weren't that available yet. Like, you couldn't go to your garden center and say, oh, I want to buy a roll of floating row cover. It really wasn't the kinds of products that we now have available to us. So it was pretty much people just relied on insecticides, and I didn't want to use them in my garden. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to hand pick and I'm going to do these other IPM kinds of things. And my garden was not very successful.
See, and IPM is a lot easier to do, I would think,
yes.
In Utah.
Yes.
So my squash bugs, I go out and I pick them off, go out every other day for a couple of weeks, boom, I'm done.
Right.
And I can't think of another insect that I really have to be paying attention to that much. I mean, I'll get aphids on the broccoli and I'll spray them off on occasion, but it just isn't that much of an issue.
We really have it good here in terms of much fewer pests. And
the pathogens, I could just imagine if you look at mildew.
Exactly. I was going to mention, if you look at where the organic agriculture is concentrated in this country, it's heavily concentrated in the West. And the reasons for that are much less pest pressure, and a big part of that is the pathogens. We just don't, with our drier climate, we don't have the fungal infections for the most part that they have in the eastern, midwestern, and eastern United States, which makes it much harder to grow organically than it is here, does here in the West.
So appreciate your Western environment while you're here. The next item, and this one was one of my favorite, it's DNA from spider web reveals the species of spider and its prey.
Yeah.
I'd never thought about that before, but it makes sense.
Yeah, this was a really innovative research project as well, where a group of a couple guys at Notre Dame University said, we're trying to come up with ways that we can detect DNA in the environment without having to destruct or destroy the object, the organism that we're trying to detect in the process. So they got this wise idea that, you know, spider silk is sticky. Don't you think if a spider that had crawled across it, or a fly or other cricket or other prey that had been caught in that web, could leave some enough DNA behind on that sticky surface that we could detect it and actually even identify using genetic barcoding which species it was. And so they set about doing that. They had spiders at a nearby zoo in South Bend, Indiana. And they put out some spiders that would make webs, so they knew that right where they could go to sample. And then they went back and sampled, and sure enough, they were able to detect the species of spider and the species of prey that had been caught in the net, or at least had spent some time in the net.
So it's not so much what the spider has ingested,
right,
and then comes out in the silk. It's the insect actually crawling across the spider web.
Right, and so this was, again, a new technique. People have known that we can go out and collect insects, and we can, you know, by DNA detection, know which species they are, but also even look at gut contents to know what they've eaten, say if we're interested in trying to sample what a predator might be eating in the environment. But this was the first time that somebody had shown you can actually sample some kind of structure in the surface in the environment and tell what had been there. And so this has lots of implications for conservation research and other kinds of questions where, again, you don't want to have to destructively sample the material. So I thought it was very interesting and novel to think about using spider webs.
Well, this got some great information. I hope you'll stay with us. We're going to take a quick moment and be back here in about a minute. It's the Zesty Garden. If you'd like to join our conversation, Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, is in studio. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Ask away any insect question. 1-800-826-1495. She knows most everything, but if she doesn't, she'll tell you. So please call in.
And I could tell you where you can find it. So
yes.
I know a lot of you, like my husband right now, have been looking through your seed catalogs and maybe even starting some seeds, as my husband is doing. So you're thinking about those gardens coming up. And so now's the time to think about what you want to do for pest management this coming year, or the problems that you had in your garden last year.
And we'll promo next week's program because Dan Drost will be in studio. We can talk about the different vegetables that should be started right now.
This time of year. Yeah. It's not too early.
Well, stay tuned. You can also send us an email question or comment. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, and you'll see a post about today's program that you can also question or comment at that point. So leafhopper control, let's take a look at that one. This one I found really interesting because it's not using a chemical control, but it's using a mechanical control.
Right, yeah, simulating vibrational sounds of insects. And so this is an interesting insect situation in that the insect is called the American leafhopper. And leafhoppers are these little tiny insects that have a piercing, sucking mouth part, and they suck the sap out of leaves and other plant structures, and they're everywhere. This particular one is native to North America on the vineyards that are the wild grapes that grow here in North America. But what happened back in the 1800s is this species of, so we always talk about invasive insects that come here to the U.S. This is the reverse. We exported a pest to Europe, where the grapevines there were much more affected, much more sensitive to this particular leafhopper when it was brought there on grape materials back in the 1800s.
They were decimated by some disease, had gone through, and so they got American grapevines.
Right, and then they accidentally imported this American leafhopper. But then what it ended up doing was there was a protoplasma disease, a bacterium, type of bacterium that's there in Europe called Flavescens dorée. It must be a French name anyway. And this leafhopper started vectoring it around in the European vineyards. And so then they started having tremendous loss. And so we do export invasives sometimes too. But so one of the challenges with this management of this insect is that really it's all been chemical control, because once this phytoplasma gets moved to a grapevine or to a planting, then they have to pretty much take it out and start over. And so if you want to grow any organic grapes, this really has not been very possible because of this leafhopper vectoring this phytoplasma disease.
And the leafhopper itself does not communicate with each other through pheromones?
So that's right.
What it is?
They found, you know, it had been thought that probably all insects use pheromones to some extent, but some recent work has shown that at least for this group of leafhoppers, I don't want to say it applies to all leafhoppers, but they really don't use chemical odors like so many other insects do for that prime communication. And what they use instead is vibrational movements, so mechanical movements. And so when males are searching for females, they'll do a certain movement, vibration, and the females can pick that up. And if they're interested, they could move towards that. Males will also listen in, or that's not listen, it's not the right term, but feel for vibrations of females. And then when they detect females, they'll move towards them. And they find each other and mating occurs. And then they even interestingly found out that another male can try to thwart a mating event between another male and a female by making certain sounds to disrupt that. And so it's vibrational warfare, or mating warfare, if you want to call that.
And so it's using that same, how do they transfer, create the vibration that mimics what the male usually does?
So a group of researchers in Italy thought, well, you know, we already have these trellised grapevines. You know, the vines are grown in rows and they use wire, lines of wire to trellis them up, hold the vines up for them to grow on. And so that's, you know how when you like pluck like a guitar string or something, you pluck that wire, you know that it sends out a vibrational signal. So they determined the vibrational kinds of signals these leafhoppers were giving out, and then they had some device, doesn't really explain the device in any kind of detail, that mimicked that on the wire line, trellis lines, and they were able to disrupt the leafhopper communication for up to 10 meters away from where they had installed the little vibrational device. And so what they said and concluded is on a larger scale, you would need to have one of these about every 20 meters because it can reach 10 meters in each direction. And it sounds like it's a very simple device, and this could be installed and reduce the amount of leafhoppers and thus the amount of vectoring of this phytoplasma.
So it's not something where they're shaking. I mean, they are shaking the plant, but it's being done through the wires that are holding up.
Right, exactly.
Holding up the plant itself. And I would imagine that there's only a certain period of time that these leafhoppers show up, so they don't have to do it the whole growing season.
So there's only certain times of the day that they're most active, so they were able to then, you know, with this, these are battery-operated devices, but you could have a timer, a very simple timer on them where it was set to only vibrate at certain times of the day when the leafhoppers were active.
So I got pairs of leafhoppers were released in cages wrapped around grapevine shoots and left for 24 hours, then recaptured and checked whether they had mated. Noise playback prevented mating in these conditions too, leaving as many as 90% of the females virgin, while only 20% remained virgin when the noise was not played.
That's right.
So that's pretty significant.
Right. And so they felt like even though this sounds a little crazy and, you know, could you scale this up for commercial use, but for someone who's trying to grow organic grapes, this could be a very useful tool to be able to achieve that.
And maybe it will mean something for other insects as well.
The future, yeah. So first exploration of this kind of vibrational management of an insect.
Well, we're going to take a quick break right now, and then we'll be back. So I hope you'll stay with us. It's The Zesty Garden. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I have Diane Alston in with me. She's USU's extension entomologist. And our next topic that we're looking at is backyard chickens harbor greater diversity of ticks, mites, and lice than farm-raised chickens. And when you think about it, well, most farm-raised chickens don't get to wander around. They're not free-range. They're kept in cages. So the environment supposedly is going to be cleaner. I know my chickens are roaming through two different pastures right behind my property, for which we've gotten permission from the landowners, to, and they're picking up insects, and so it might make sense that they have more of them. I've never seen any stick-tight fleas, as this photo is showing, on their combs, but there might be something else. But they're able to do dust baths.
Right.
If you've ever seen a chicken who... they just like certain places with loose soil so they can flip dirt onto their feathers. They're trying to stay clean,
right,
actually.
And they conclude at the end that that's one of the main ways to help your backyard chickens stay healthy is to make sure they have access to dust for dust bathing. And then they give some suggestions of other things you can maybe add or provide to that, such as diatomaceous earth or kaolin clay, that if your chickens were willing to roll around in that, that could all, if you're having a particular problem with some pests on the chickens, that you could use those to help supplement the dust baths.
So I'd imagine that home-raised chickens tend to have a better environment, or at least as far as being happy.
Right. People that own, you're a chicken owner, do you think your chickens are pretty happy?
Well, of course they're happy.
Okay.
I don't know how happy they are with the cold weather, but
right.
I'm thinking that they are more comfortable.
Right.
Being where they are rather than being shut up in a cage all the time.
Oh, yeah. I read some of these magazine articles and things for instructions of how to build chicken coops and mobile chicken coops. And I just think, boy, some of these whole backyard chickens are treated like kings and queens, aren't they? They really have the sweet life. And this article here does talk about how, yes, we do give our backyard chickens access to lots of great places to roam. And it does tend to make the arthropods, the primary ones they found were lice, mites, and ticks, on them more diverse. So you might say, ooh, that's a bad thing. If they're kept in a closed house, they're going to have fewer. But sometimes having that diversity may not always be a bad thing. Sometimes it also means there's access to natural enemies that will attack those pests on the chickens. And sometimes having some diversity may make that none of them are that severe. They're kind of low levels in a more natural setting versus a closed environment where, say, one particular pest might really get abundant and cause some health problems for the chickens.
I just had this vision in my mind of how hippos have those birds that walk around
yes,
on them and pick off.
Right. That's what the chickens need.
the chicken birds, something to walk around and eat off and clean off the insects.
So did you look to see which were the most common kinds of arthropods that they found in terms of the different kinds of lice and so forth?
I did not. So why don't you tell
yeah. So they found the two primary species of lice they found were one called the chicken body louse and another one called the fluff louse. Now, lice are a very tiny, we were talking about book lice earlier. So these are a complement to the book lice. Book lice feeding on, not being a parasite on an animal, but this is a complementary group of lice that are parasites on different kinds of animals. In this case, these two are on chickens. And so they're very tiny, and so most people would never see them. But if they do get very abundant, they can cause a stress to the chicken because they are feeding on the blood and on the skin and on the feathers and so forth. And so, it's just like if we had a high parasite load in our own bodies, it would start to stress our system. And so that can decrease the amount of eggs they lay. If you're breeding them for size, for meat chicken, they won't get as large. They won't live as long. They may not breed as well. So all those kinds of factors that can lead to a less happy chicken if you let these lice get too abundant.
I would also imagine if you are giving them the feed that they need, and especially the access to fresh water that they need, that they're going to be able to fend them off easier as
well. Right. And again, we talked about the dust baths. That's one of the prime natural tools that chickens use to help keep themselves with low numbers of these kinds of ectoparasites. So another group were the ticks, and you mentioned these stick-tight fleas. These are the ones that tend to be right around the head region, around the eyes and the comb. and they're just little tiny fleas that kind of, they burrow their heads in, and so they're kind of, you go to pull them out and they're hard to extract. And then the more common one is the northern fowl mite, which is very mm-hmm. common on chickens, and also the scaly leg mite, which they found, as well as a chicken red mite, which I had never heard of that one before. This study was done in Southern California, by the way, so their warmer climate probably have a little more variety of arthropods than we do here.
Well, unfortunately, they don't infest or bite humans, these insects.
None of them are human infesting.
It says that you can wash the chicken, and that might do it once, but I wouldn't make a regular case of it because it's removing
the oils
that the chicken produces and it is used naturally produced oils and dust bathing to keep their feathers in good shape. So
yeah, the way they actually sampled for these different lice, ticks, and mites were to use a soapy water bath. But as you just said, that was only recommended as a sampling method, not as a control. And then they also used some pyrethrins, which are the organic version of the pyrethroids, to kill the insects, the arthropods on the chicken body, so that they could remove them to look at them and identify them. But yeah, the bottom line was you should keep your chickens healthy and happy with a diverse environment, and just make sure you provide them with clean food, water, dust baths, and if you have some severe infestations, you might want to look into providing some additional materials that they could use to do their dust bath in that could help reduce these pests.
So maybe just putting in the diatomaceous mm-hmm. earth where you naturally
right.
see them doing
right.
that?
Just adding some to their dust bath area.
Hmm.
Yes.
Well, there's some dust bath areas I would prefer that they didn't go into. It
yeah.
seems like wherever I till fresh soil, they make a beeline for it.
Yeah, how do you control where they do their dust baths?
Well, I have a fence, but I've found, and I don't know how they do this, there's a couple of offenders that like to fly up and over the mm-hmm. fence, so I cut some of their feathers, and somehow they're still able to get over the fence. I don't know how that's working, but I'm going to have to fence out my new blackberries that I put in last year so they don't dig them up.
So they don't dig them up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they mentioned kale and clay is another product that may provide some control of those ectoparasites as well.
Well, we've got about a minute left. So tell me what we should be concerned about as far as the upcoming season. It's cold right now. So
right, it's cold right now. But just planning ahead, like, you know, again, looking back at your last season, it's always good to take some notes, keep a garden journal, and write down things about that you observe, that different types of plants, varieties of plants that worked well, didn't work well, which pests you observed, which were particularly abundant and caused, you know, crop loss. And so look back at those notes and just start making a plan for how you want to lay out your garden this year. Always think about rotating. So if you had tomatoes, potatoes, peppers in a particular area last year, don't put plants of that same family back in that same spot. Move to a different kind of plant, like the cabbage family or beans or something like that, so that you're trying to break up the life cycles of some of these pests and move those plants around in your garden from year to year.
Okay. Thank you, Diane.
You're welcome.
Right now, we have our gardening calendar. The USU Botanical Center in Kaysville is hosting a weekly landscape design series workshop on Thursday afternoons, 3:30 to 5:30, beginning tonight. The 5-week course will explore the origins of garden design, how to create a landscape map, and designing your own garden using the latest in computer-aided design. The cost is $149, and registration is required. Information is at usubotanicalcenter.org. And USU Extension in Cache County presents a seed selection and planning your garden class on Friday, February 19th, 6 to 8 p.m. in the multipurpose room of the Cache County building. It's free and open to everyone, but registration is required. Call 752-6263 for more information. And if you have an item for the Zesty Garden calendar, wherever you listen to us, please let us know about it. You can send it to zestygarden@gmail.com. You can put it on the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, or you can just call 1-800-826-1495, and we'll get it on the calendar. Coming up next is Petals and Prose with Helen Cannon.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and I'm continuing to read to you from a delightful book called Onward and Upward in the Garden by Catherine White, E.B. White's wife, and this is E.B. White's introduction to her book. Onward and Upward, a phrase swiped from the Unitarian Creed, had often appeared in the New Yorker as a heading in other contexts. It was Catherine's invention, however, and it proved a happy choice of title for her adventure in garden writing. After 2 years of giving the catalogs an annual going over and accessing of the prose style and idiosyncrasies of writers, she set to work, onward and upward, exploring other aspects of the garden world, the history of gardens, the literature of gardens, the arranging of flowers, the herbalists, the trends and developments. She was blessed with a curious mind, and she ranged widely. She continually revealed her own prejudices, her likes and dislikes, her crutches. Catherine was a traditionalist, not only in garden, but everywhere else. She preferred the simple to the ornate, the plain to the fancy, the relaxed to the formal, the single to the double, the medium-sized to the giant. She detested abbreviations such as snaps, mums, glads, dells. She did not care for flowers that, to her eye, were gross or pretentious or stiff. She seldom grew dahlias or gladiolas on our place. She loved old clay pots, despised new plastic ones, the hideous green lavender of gray plastic pot, often striated with pink. She knew where she stood, and she was not a woman who looked with indulgence on a pot striated with pink. Studying the Burpee catalog of 1959, she gazed fearfully ahead to the time when our garden beds would be full of great shaggy heads, alike except for color, all just great blobs of bloom. When she discovered a zinnia named Miss Universe, 7 inches across, she was reminded of her own plight as a girl when a relative informed her that the great knot of hair on the back of her head was a deformity. She deeply loathed artificial flowers, considered them a crime against nature, and once, reading in the papers that the city of Washington was to be favored with some artificial shrubbery, she dashed off a letter of complaint to Lady Bird Johnson. The newspaper report turned out to be false, and the reply she received from the First Lady was a model of friendly reassurance and moral support. Not only was she a traditionalist by nature, Catherine showed a strong streak of parochialism in her approach to gardening. New England was what she knew as a child, and the roots of her ancestors went deep in the soil of Maine and Massachusetts. The things that grew in New England, therefore, were correct. They occupied a special place in her heart, an authenticity not enjoyed by flowers that made the mistake of blooming in other sections of the country. In my bumbling way, I ran straight into this regional bias when I introduced a few camellia plants into the small greenhouse we had acquired. This was in the last years of her life, when her days were becoming increasingly dreary because of invalidism, and I was casting about for ways to give her a few scattered moments of pleasure against the somber backdrop of illness. I must have seen, years before, what she had written about camellias. Quote, "My eye admires them, even while my taste rejects them. I live in an old New England farmhouse, against which these lush blooms have gone out of my mind. So I send off for several camellia plants, thinking to cheer her up. The plants arrived from the West Coast by Greyhound bus and soon came into bloom. Tiffany, Betty Sheffield, Supreme, Ville de Nantes, and other handsome little things. Proud of myself, I would make a quick trip to the greenhouse and came back with a single flower, put it in a tiny vase, and have it on a tray when I carried her breakfast up to her room. Just a small surprise, courtesy of the management. How pretty," she would exclaim. But Catherine was never good at concealing her true feelings. She would have been the world's worst poker player. I soon detected, on those early morning visits, a forced note in her voice. I could almost hear her muttering under her breath, "Now what is a southern flower doing in my main bedroom?" How she loved shopping in catalogs. Hour after hour, she studied, sifted, pondered, rejected, sorted. In the delirium of future blooming and fruiting, Harris was her dream catalog. It was always within reach. No longer able to sit at a desk or typewriter, she had abandoned her cozy study at the front of the house and had taken up a place at the end of the living room sofa, propped with pillows. This became the control center of the house. The sofa served as a desk as well as a seat, and it soon became buried under a mountain of catalogs, books, letters, files, memoranda, Kleenex, ashtrays, and miscellany. The extraordinary accumulation, which would have driven me crazy, never seemed to annoy her or slow her up. I built her a coffee table to catch the overflow from the sofa. The table was soon groaning under its own load, yet she usually knew where something was, however deeply it was buried. Although she spent a lot of time in dreamy admiration of the seductive pictures in catalogs, the impossible tomato, the ultimate rose, she was actually a hard-headed planner and organizer. She did little of the physical work of gardening herself. In her youth, she lacked the time. In age, she lacked the strength. Henry Allen, our caretaker and himself an ardent gardener, was her strong right arm. But she masterminded everything. She got her seed orders in early, sometimes directing the campaign from her bed in a hospital. And we always ended up with a vegetable garden that loaded our freezer and nourished our bodies, and with flower borders that filled the eye and spirit. She shopped among the seedsmen lavishly but cannily. One of the minor amusements I enjoyed for some 40 years was watching my wife fix flowers, an operation that in our house in Maine usually took a few minutes before lunch. Newspapers would be spread out on a round yellow table on the north porch, our summer dining room. Vases would be set out, and Catherine would arrive, fresh from the cutting garden, bearing baskets of assorted blooms, maybe 75 flowers in all, from which four or five arrangements she would build to fit the spaces for flowers in our house. She had picked the flowers not at random, but with uncanny accuracy, the right kinds, the right length of stems, the right colors, to fulfill exactly some deep mental image she had of the final results. She never hesitated. She was never confused. She was quite rough with the flowers, as if to say, if you can't take the heat, go away somewhere and wilt. She worked quickly, deftly, and seemingly without a plan. This last was not true. Her head was full of blueprints, images of finished bouquets, and she worked in bold strokes to achieve them, a style. I'm sure she would have amazed the judges of the National Council. Sometimes I sat quietly in my corner watching her throw flowers at each other. It looked as though she were playing darts in an English pub. Whenever I could, I attended these flower arranging sessions. They lasted only 10 or 15 minutes because it was a little like going to a magic show. She seldom spoke during the show, seldom commented on the finished product. Once in a while, she would make a pronouncement, sotto voce, there, that's pretty. But there was always the hint of a question mark buried in there. Is it really pretty? For Catherine, a room without a flowering plant was an empty shell. After she became so weakened by failing health that she required constant nursing, I equipped her bedroom with a hospital bed, a hospital table that spanned the bed, an oxygen kit, and a wonderful green device called bird respirator. The patient gazed quizzically at this orderly and aseptic scene and immediately countered by calling for a bird of paradise plant in a pub. It was duly brought in and was about the size of a Shetland pony. Soon it was producing its bizarre parrot-like blossoms. It was a lecherous old thing, always grabbing at the nurses as they went by. We finally arranged matters so the bird respirator, when not in use, could sit lurking behind the bird of paradise out of sight. It all worked out very nicely. The room was acceptable again, and I'm sure that Catherine hated the flower almost as much as she hated the machine because she hated big, showy flowers. But when the necessity arose to cover up one of the machines for her breathing, she had to resort to this bird of paradise plant. Well, this is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and next time I will go to Catherine's writing about catalogs in her chapter called A Romp in the Catalogs. Thank you for listening to me, Helen Cannon, with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.